Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We're talking cocktails, a family's restaurant history, and a little wine today here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, and I'm so glad you've tuned in. First, we'll catch up with Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis and talk about what's happening with cocktail culture. We'll hear about a new lineup of old school drinks and why Joshua has mudslides and Singapore slings on an upcoming Thunderbird menu. We'll also check in with restaurateur Katie Harris of Iozzo's Garden of Italy in Indianapolis. The restaurant opened on South Meridian Street in 2009, but her family's restaurant history goes back to the Prohibition era. We'll hear about the tragic end of the family's restaurant in the 1940s and about how she brought Iozzo's back to Indianapolis. And what's new, especially when it comes to wine. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. What's next? That's a key question in any category, but especially when it comes to dining and drinking. We're all looking for the next big thing. But what do you do when trend spotters haven't spotted anything on the horizon? Well, you just decide to have fun. That's what Thunderbird owner Joshua Gonzalez has done with a new cocktail menu at his Fountain Square Bar. And he and his staff will be having lots of fun with old school drinks like Singapore slings, rum runners, and pina coladas when they sport the pastel colors of 1980s Miami Vice and launch a new cocktail menu. Joshua talks about the current lull in the cocktail scene and how his new menu is all about injecting some fun. So we're talking cocktail culture. What does that mean, and how does that apply in Indianapolis?
It's dead. The cocktail culture is, like, nationally, I think, is in a weird place. We were just talking off mic a little bit.
Yeah, how so?
Like, you know, a lull, I think, occurring across the board, not just here, but everywhere. Think about, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, you had what, Ball and Biscuit, Libertine. That was about it.
Mm-hmm.
Even, and if you go, you know, nationally, even larger markets, that style of those styles of bars, that style of cocktail, was still kind of a novelty, right?
Right. So it was coming on.
Yeah, it's coming on fairly new.
Here.
Yeah.
Right.
Even in bigger markets, you had that explosion occurring faster than it did here, but that style of drinking was still sort of, like I said, that was still a novel experience.
Yeah, it was kind of new here. You know, the focus on craft cocktails.
The craft, the process,
right,
the techniques.
All the ingredients,
right,
that kind of thing. So, yeah, so that was
focus
kind of
on balance and creativity.
Right. So that was fun and,
yeah,
and new, like you said. And then we saw other places open, you know,
yes,
more focus on cocktails. And then kind of what happened?
Well, I think it just became ubiquitous, right? So every place that opens, you have to have a cocktail program now, right? To the point that...
A cocktail program.
A cocktail program. So, you know, a menu, everybody expects that as a guest coming in, that there's going to be a wine program, a beer program, a cocktail program. So it becomes, like I said, a less novel.
It's an expectation.
Expected and sort of standard practice in any new bar or restaurant that's opening. Is that a good thing or bad thing? That's, you know, for the consumer to decide. But I think from a guest perspective, what happens is it tends to sort of water the playing field down a little bit. And those places that were doing something special, or maybe, you know, from a comparison standpoint, there's not a lot of difference between A and B or,
right,
you know, C and D.
Right. This cocktail list is not all that different,
yeah,
from that,
yeah,
cocktail
or
list.
From a guest, too, sort of understanding, like, the processes that one place is taking versus the processes that another place is going through could be vastly different.
Right.
So your quality levels could be vastly different. But again, no one really knows that.
Right. You know, so even, we don't see that.
Yeah, you don't see that.
You know,
even
we see the cocktail
list. You see the cocktails, yeah.
Right.
And even from a, you know, from the employees, like, nobody really knows what X bar is doing or how they're operating versus another bar.
So there are differences, but, you know, from the consumer side,
yeah,
we've become kind of accustomed to it.
Yeah, for sure. And so, same thing's happening in the kitchens, right?
Oh, absolutely. So yeah. we've become accustomed to, creative menus,
sure,
and, local sourcing and lots
rotating
of...
rotating food items.
Exactly, changing menus, yeah, seasonality, that sort of thing. So that does something then to the atmosphere, right?
Yeah, like I said, I think it kind of waters it down. It takes, because it's expected, it often becomes less special.
Okay, right. So that perhaps has happened.
I think, yeah? So. Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, if you're looking at growing, to larger markets, you're seeing, we've seen a contraction here, but it's happening in other places too.
Is it? So after the big growth of the last, let's say, 5 to 8 years.
Sure.
So now we're starting to see, some, like you said, a contraction.
Yeah,
in the market.
The contraction's occurring, and I think too that I think the cool thing about that though is that, you're asking about trends earlier, and I'm like struggling, right? And even asking other people in other cities, I was in Portland last week and chatting with a bunch of industry friends, and they're all saying the same kind of thing. Like, well, I don't know. Like, we're in a kind of a lull right now. Nobody's really doing anything that exciting or innovative. New York, a couple bartenders just got into like a big thing about how the New York has always been sort of the driver,
sure,
in creativity, and how there's nothing really exciting happening there right now, and everyone's sort of...
Are we all waiting?
I think we're waiting and unsure of what is
right?
next, right?
So we're waiting for the next thing.
Yeah, yeah, but who knows what that is?
Well, right, so that's the key. So you happen upon that, and then
yeah,
wow,
so
right?
For me, it was like I just got kind of tired of it, right? Like, I got tired of the... changing a menu 4 times a year is tough.
Right.
Right. Putting 4 cocktail menus out takes a lot of work. Constantly reinventing the drinks, is very challenging. You're seeing the prices escalate like considerably, right?
Well, no, that is true. So prices certainly have gone up.
Prices escalate, sort of, the need to sort of always be pushing the envelope, becomes a driver for a bartender, oftentimes to a point that it's not necessarily needed, right? So, like
it changes
I said,
it
changes just to change, right? Or weird ingredients for weird ingredients. I mean, you're still seeing menus with 9 ingredient cocktails. Like, that's not necessary. There's ways to develop flavors without, muddling flavors or hiding things.
That does seem to be a bit excessive and
yeah,
probably not very practical,
from a bartending
standpoint.
And to execute drinks like that, it's great. you're not saving yourself any time or any, you're giving yourself more headaches.
Well, no, you have done that in the past.
Oh,
though.
For sure.
You,
I'm guilty
you
of
were,
it.
You were,
oh, yeah.
You have been, the...
I've made all those mistakes.
But, you have been behind the bar. You're now an owner.
Yeah.
So you have seen all of this.
I've seen all that come go. So, what we did with the new menu, I'm actually really excited about this. I came to the crew about a month ago, and I was like, guys, it's about going to be time for us to change the menu. I'm kind of tired of this process. I want to do something very different than what we've done in the past. And it's an idea we've kind of toyed with before, but we never really fully committed to it. So I said, I just want to do bad drinks, like drinks from the 80s we used to drink.
You're talking about like silly retro, older drinks,
Yeah. So I was like, let's write a list down of cocktails that I used to order at bars when I was 21.
Back in the day. Right?
Back in the day, in the late 90s. That you don't really see anymore. Sometimes people occasionally order, and my bartender's like, "Oh, I don't know how to make
that."
Oh gosh,
right? I have to make up.
Or they just have no idea.
Right.
Like, what is Alabama Slammer, right? and I don't have SoCo or like peach schnapps. Like, what am I going to do?
Sorry. Oh no,
peach
schnapps.
I don't have those ingredients.
So this is kind of fun. So instead of working on, the next big innovative serious menu, you're kind of...
I just wanted to
kind
have fun.
Turned it around and you're going with some silly drinks, right?
Yeah, so we're doing a Singapore Sling. We're doing a Rum Runner. We've got Mudslide that's incredible.
But there's a reason why people ordered those drinks.
Because they're fun, right? Like, they're fun drinks. Like, I like a Mudslide. It's a good cocktail.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah, it tastes like, who doesn't want to drink something that tastes like, chocolate, coffee, milk? So we're doing a Mudslide. We've got a Hurricane. We've got, what else do we have on there? Blue Hawaiian.
Oh my goodness! So these are things like I, you know, they look like you're going to open up a cocktail book and see all these colorful pictures. You know, blues and greens,
yes,
and oranges,
and that's exactly what we did.
So you have a very colorful menu. Colorful, now.
It's gorgeous. It's pastels, all the cocktails, and some by design, but more sort of a happy accident that all the drinks turned out to be these like beautiful pastel colors. And so we're doing Miami Vice themed. We're like the whole bar is getting tricked out in Miami Vice gear. We've got posters of Crockett and Tubbs ordered.
So if you're going to wear, you're going to wear a pink tie or something.
Yeah, the
like
bartenders
that.
Are committed to it. I hit him up last night late and I was like, hey, you guys, are we going to be dressing up for this? And everybody's like, yeah, we've already got gear ready to go. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess I need to get on board.
That's right. You need to get that linen suit.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm about it. And
the pastel tie.
But I also want to do summer drinks. I was like, again, I hate the seasonality aspect of cocktails. So I was like, let's do summer drinks in the fall.
Okay.
So that's why, you know, we've got pina colada that's amazing, strawberry daiquiri.
Goodness. Oh, my goodness.
So we're actually going to be serving the original Miami Vice cocktail, which is a blend of pina colada and strawberry daiquiris blended together. So
oh, my goodness.
We're going to be testing out this weekend. Menu goes live next Thursday.
So this is fun. So so this is to keep up your interest and your staff's interest and
the
customer's
interest. I think it was actually a really
interest.
Cool process for the staff, giving them like reverse engineering drinks, right? So we looked up all the old recipes online. A lot of them are just, you know, an ounce of orange juice, an ounce of grenadine, an ounce of some kind of flavored vodka. And so it was like, how do we create these flavors using what we have in-house? It was great. Like everybody came to the table. They really put on the creative hats and were really thinking and challenging themselves, making some really amazing syrups. We've got this beautiful coffee syrup we flavored with some star anise and clove.
Is this for the mudslide?
For the mudslide, yeah. Which actually we're using tequila and mezcal. And so, but the flavors are brilliant. Mike, who's new to our team, and he's just been a great ball of energy. He made this really phenomenal blackberry Jamaican spiced syrup. It's just incredibly delicious for our rum runner. I've got this beautiful passion fruit honey syrup for the pina colada. We're making our coconut cream in house.
Okay, now see this sounds, you know, this is like a pina colada only better.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, so I made a vanilla syrup that's spiced with some clove and cinnamon, and then blended that with coconut milk. It's fairly heavily salted too.
Yeah,
but it's delicious. Yeah, and then you know the strawberry daiquiri. We went down and grabbed a bunch of fresh strawberries from market, made a delicious syrup, and that's spiced with some ancho chili. So, they're
nice.
The old school drinks done in Thunderbird style. Right?
Okay, so so what's the upshoot of this kind of menu fun? You know, it seems like it's going to create some. Yeah, I don't know, some energy around a new menu that might not be there.
Yeah, and the crew was just really excited about it. And I think a lot of times when you're putting new menus together, you're kind of working blindly in terms of what, you know, I might give some direction in terms of flavors that we're looking for, or specific products that we want to use. But this time, they just kind of had free reign within this little narrow box, right?
Right.
But I think it was from a creativity standpoint, giving them some parameters like that really kept them focused. Whereas sometimes those menus can get like spiral out of control, and you've got like, you know, everybody's working on seven drinks at once, and you're kind of all over the place, and there's not a lot of focus. So it was cool from that perspective to see the crew really get excited about particular drinks, you know, and work through them how to create those flavors. And that was the fun part too. Is like, I really want this flavor, but I don't want to use any of these ingredients. So how do we replicate that in-house? How do we make those flavors in-house? So they learned. It was a good learning process for them as well. But I think, too, you know, I put the menu up, or a teaser of the cocktails a few days ago, and just the reaction on Instagram was insane. People were going, you know, tons of comments, tons of likes, when's it dropping? And we garnished them in very old-school ways as well. So, you know, we're using the big bleached cherries, you know, the big pineapple slices,
right.
Umbrellas, skewers. We just wanted it to be fun. And I think that was, for me, you know, sort of as we move forward, I want to maintain that fun factor. And we've always been we've never really taken ourselves that serious in terms of how we present cocktails. We always try to have a fun presentation, whether it be, you know, an action figure garnish or something,
true.
Right? but I think this time around, you know, it's about fun. It's about the visual. excitement of the drink. It's about sort of that nostalgia for those drinks that you don't see that much anymore.
Well, you don't see a Mai Tai or a Singapore Sling anywhere.
You don't see any Clouders or anything like that very often. So, and I think it'll just be a very fun and energizing menu. The colors are vibrant. The garnishes are vibrant. Colored straws, umbrellas. It's kitschy without being, we're not trying to go in like a tiki direction or anything like that. We're just doing
just fun, right?
Yeah, just fun drinks.
We've been talking with Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis. We'll be right back with more from Joshua here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, talking with local bar owner Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Fountain Square. And we're talking growth, how the local cocktail culture has grown and what that's meant for the Indianapolis bar scene. As more spots have opened, Indy's hospitality industry has seen more challenges in staffing and development and in how to keep up the excitement. Joshua talks about competitions, about new faces behind the bar, and about keeping the fun going. Could talk just a little bit about kind of where the city has come in cocktails. So take us back a little bit and talk a little bit about the development of sort of cocktail culture in Indianapolis.
Yeah, well, I think, you really can't say anything about the development until you met, Zach Wilkes was the guy that kind of brought that idea of classic cocktails and the idea of craft to the city, right? And he was doing it at what was the old space before Ball and Biscuit, the Bugs Temple space that he was operating out of there for a while, doing oysters and Caesar salads and aviations and sidecars,
right?
And then Ball and Biscuit, when you think about it, was like pretty ahead of its time in terms of what was happening on Mass Ave, what was happening downtown.
Oh, exactly.
There wasn't a hub of excitement on that corner, really. The scene was still Broad Ripple at the time. That was kind of where the bars were 8 years ago. I think it's about as long as Ball and Biscuit's been open.
Mass Ave has really come along.
Mass Ave's exploded
in that period of time.
And again, you can argue positive and negatives about the growth of Mass Ave.
Well, exactly. So we've seen the transition from sort of the art district
to
more restaurant and nightlife.
Sure. Yeah. It's gotten to a place where, unfortunately, the local businesses are maybe priced out, local owners, operators coming
out. The more people come, the rents go up.
And now you're seeing the more chain restaurants coming in and operating, which is fine. That's great. But along with that growth, right, has come the expectations from guests of having these cocktail programs, these beer programs, these wine programs.
The expectations that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and then when you have 30 restaurants opening within a year, where does that talent go? Where are you pulling talent? Are people capable? Like, those are all the questions.
Well, now that is a question. So that is a challenge facing the industry.
Everybody. Yeah. And I mean, not
talent,
just in Indy,
right?
It's everywhere. Like, you ask anybody, where do I find bartenders? And everyone's clamoring, like, I need experienced bartenders to run my programs, and I don't have anybody. I need experienced chefs to run my kitchens, and I can't find anybody. That's definitely part of the problems with the growth. And I'm sure that's in, any industry.
Well, now you do a lot with developing your talent.
I mean, that's one of the things I take a lot of pride
big
in.
Focus on training.
Is getting people up to speed as quickly as we possibly can. I mean, there's, any given point, we've got a couple hundred products behind the bar, bourbons, rums, tequilas. So it's necessary for them to understand those products, taste through those products.
With the training comes, chances to show off that training a little bit and competitions and that sort of thing. Now, you've done a lot of competitions in the past.
Yeah, the competition side, it's gotten that, that's another thing exploded, right? I mean, there's a competition once a month in town for some brand. And then you have the sort of the larger, like, regional ones. Espolone cocktail fights are coming up in about 2 months, I think, or September, October-ish. That's a really fun sort of take. And the cool thing about how the competitions have evolved is certain brands have gone the very serious route, you know, like world-class, taking this sort of style of bartending to a completely another, like high level, just incredibly high level. It's like the, you know, Olympics of bartending. And then you have the Espolòn cocktail fights, which is like, you know, none of that. It's not serious.
Right, not serious. It's very fun.
Yeah, you dress up like pro wrestlers and, you know, throw glasses at each other and win a wrestling bout. So, you know, that's cool. And then there's everything in between.
Right.
So the competitions, I think, are incredibly important in developing new talents, confidence, and ability to – because I think one of the things that I've noticed as I've brought in a lot of new bartenders and young bartenders. I mean, my crew right now is like, everybody's like 20, 25, 23. So it's young, right? Young kids. Having that confidence behind the bar. The competitions are cool because it forces those young kids to develop a personality.
And to interact
with and to interact
become,
with the judges.
Comfortable.
Yeah, and become comfortable with that showmanship that I think is super important.
Is it still the showmanship?
You don't really see a whole lot of it, right? That personality,
right?
And then, like for me, a lot of times too, I'll get like a bad Yelp review or something because I like to be a little like aggressive with the crews or aggressive with the people that are coming in, like because that's sort of my style. But some people take it the wrong way. So I'm not allowed to bartend that much anymore.
We have had fun we've had fun reading the bad Yelp reviews.
Like
you know,
Neil,
so that
I'm like Neil too. They hate me on Yelp.
But
I think it's the competitions are good for developing that because I think everybody kind of has to find their style and what that style is, and maybe that's relaxed and chill, or maybe it's high energy. But you know, finding the ability to command the bar, I think, is really, really important, and the competitions sort of help groom the kids for that.
Do you see anything coming down the pike that we should, you know, kind of be aware of? You know, we were talking earlier about trying to identify trends. You know, are there some things that or things that we've seen enough of that are
overdone drinks?
Going
you know,
away.
I think everybody has kind of gotten to a place where if you know the eclectic ingredients, the weird stuff, but there's going to be markets that are going to always embrace that, right? You know, they're always going to kind of be wanting that. So probably like your San Franciscos, your Portlands, stuff like that. But I think I think one of my favorite markets is always Chicago. Focused on simplicity, you know, execution, balance. But the creativity is still there. You know, you can be very creative and not have, you know, like I said, 9 ingredients in your cocktail. But I think you're seeing a trend of contracting menus. I think you're seeing the days of like sort of the big 30, 40
page
menus
after
are starting
page,
to disappear.
Right?
You're seeing the sort of the grandfathers in the game expanding nationally, but they're doing it in a very interesting way. They're tending to do it through hotels.
Oh, now
so
that's interesting.
Yeah, you're seeing like Broken Shaker out of Miami is expanding into LA and Chicago through hotels. So taking over hotel bars and running those programs. Death and Company in New York is expanding to Denver, and they're getting ready to do some other cities. But again, they're doing it through hotel properties, which is safer, and the risk is less.
Right.
So that's a smart move. So I think you'll see this sort of the growth of craft through that vehicle of, you know, nicer hotel properties that are embracing that style of drinking for their guests coming through, travelers coming through.
Does Indianapolis have a style of its own? Do we have a sort of something that characterizes Indianapolis?
That's a great question, and I don't know how to answer that. I think we are kind of in a reset mode in the city for the scene, and kind of talking to Jessica Taylor and Michael Gray, some of the older guys that were back in the day when we were bartending. We've kind of seen like a reset. We lost a lot of talent.
Exactly.
Over
we've talked to people here on the show before, people that are leaving. You know, been with high profile places, and they've gone to New York or Chicago or other cities.
Yeah, and that's, you know, as they should, right?
Go experience
another market and develop yourself personally. But we lost, you know, Devin Boyle, arguably, you know, one of the best bartenders in the city for a long time. He's doing great things out in New York right now, working at Saxon Parole, one of the best bars in the country. Puck from Libertine is down in Nashville doing some cool stuff. Michael Toscano from Libertines out in Brooklyn. Right. I think he's working at Dante's, which is another like phenomenal bar out there. So we lost a lot of talent, sort of the crew that I was anticipating being the next wave of managers and owners and operators, right? They all kind of left town. So it left a vacuum, I think, of talent that we're kind of still shaking out. And again, because of the explosion of the bar and restaurant world, there's just a lot of new faces.
Sure. So that's had an effect.
Yeah, so that's had an effect. And, you know, I'll teach classes for the Southern Wine and Spirits Academy once a session. And it's so weird. This last time I went, I didn't know anybody in the class, with the exception of, you know, one of my employees that's taking it. And I don't think anybody had any idea who I was. And I told Jessica,
goodness.
I was like, I don't think these people have any clue who I am.
So there has been a shakeup, a change.
Yeah. But that's good, you know, and I think that you'll find those players that are kind of the guys that are hungry. You know, Dimitri over at Livery is a guy that comes to mind, that he's always out there doing the competitions and has a good presence behind the bar, very professional. You know, I think, you know, Joey at Thunderbird has really taken on a lot of new responsibilities. I think kind of found himself behind the bar. I'm excited to see what he's doing. Brian Broussard over at, you know, I think he's managing Libertine now. He's doing some really cool stuff. Their menu is really fun and playful. But yeah, in terms of what we're doing, what I want, I just want fun drinks again. And you know, visiting other markets, hanging out at the bars, you know, like I said, I hate to call out Portland, but I was like, where's the good time bars? Where's people having fun? Like, I want to see like some energy and some life. And I was struggling to find that. So I want energy. I want life. I want fun. I want cheaper drinks, guys. $12. Come on. We can do better for our guests.
We've been talking with Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis. You can find out more about the Fountain Square Bar at thunderbirdindy.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, your host for Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, where we talk local food and drink every week here on WFYI and WFYI.org. And this week, we're talking restaurant history with Katie Harris, owner of Iozzo's Garden of Italy in Indianapolis. Now, her restaurant has been open on South Meridian Street since 2009, but her family's restaurant history goes way back, all the way to the 1930s. Katie takes us back to Prohibition-era Indianapolis when her family ran a huge restaurant on Illinois Street, the original Iozzo's Garden of Italy. She tells us about the restaurant, how you could manage to get a drink in a teacup during Prohibition, about the tragic barroom brawl that ended the family's business, and about how she brought it back to life.
In 1916, my family settled in Indianapolis. My great-grandfather, Santora Iozzo, worked for the railroads and ended up here in Indianapolis. Had a importing-exporting business in Boston before that, and then opened a grocery store here in Indianapolis. Had that from 1920 to 1929. During the Depression, they closed the grocery store, and a year later, they opened a small family dining restaurant called Naples Grill. It's at 117 and a half North Illinois Street.
This was in 1930, right?
Yes, that's correct. And then a year later, they opened a sister restaurant on North Pennsylvania Street, two blocks away. Everybody back then thought it was a little bit silly that our family had two restaurants. So the cooks had a joke that they should have a conveyor belt moving the meatballs back and forth between the two kitchens. So my great-grandfather said, okay, I understand, we'll combine our efforts and move it to one restaurant. So they opened what was known as Iozzo's Garden of Italy in 1932, set at 32-34-36 South Illinois Street, where the Hyatt Hotel sits.
So this was a big operation.
It was a huge restaurant. Their dining room sat 500 guests, and then they had a banquet room that sat 350. Two kitchens, four bars, dinner and dancing on the weekends. So when you came to dine in Indianapolis in the 1930s, you probably dined at Iozzo's.
Now, this was in the middle of the Depression, so that was even more surprising.
Absolutely. The Depression, the Prohibition, so all sorts of things kind of, like, stacked against them to make this restaurant successful. They used to have false steps leading upstairs where they used to keep casks of whiskey and wine. And if you were a friend of the family, they would give you a Fred Iozzo OK card, and you would lay it down, and in your teacup, they would either bring you whiskey or wine. Because they would know you.
You had an OK card? Oh, my goodness.
Fred Iozzo OK card, yeah. So my sister, she wants us to do an okay card, and I'm like, I don't think that we need an okay card now, but everybody's allowed to drink today. So.
But that's wonderful, family history. Yeah. But then there's sort of a kind of a tragic ending to that story, isn't it?
Absolutely. During October of 1940, a group of gentlemen come into the restaurant. My grandfather Dominic is tending bar, and his sister Mary is sitting at the end of the bar finishing up her serving shift. These gentlemen begin making passes towards my great Aunt Mary. Well, my grandfather didn't like that too much. So he said, gentlemen, you know, you need to leave. You don't have to go home, but you got to get out of here. Well, they didn't like that too much, so they began arguing. Argument led into a fight. Fight basically led into an all-out brawl where they had my grandfather on the ground, basically beating him to death. So at this point in the restaurant, there's all sorts of commotion. People are yelling and screaming. My great-grandfather, Santora, who's in the office, comes out and sees what's going on. He was like, holy, they're going to kill my son. So he goes back into the office and grabs his gun, comes out and shoots the guy. Well, at this point, the gentleman is on top of my grandfather, strangling him. The bullet passes through this gentleman and lands in my grandfather's spleen. So my great-grandfather freaks out, runs, goes, throws the gun in the dumpster, and they call the police, they call the ambulance, and if you weren't taken to the hospital, you were taken down to the police station for questioning. Nobody knows what happened. Everybody had a different story, and it was a crazy night. Well, unfortunately, later in the evening, the gentleman who the bullet passed through, the gentleman that was strangling my grandfather, passed away. So after all this is said and done, the police charged my grandfather and my great-grandfather with murder. While during the discovery process before the trial happened, they dropped the charges against my grandfather, but the charges against my great-grandfather still stood. So, as an Italian-American in January of 1941 going to trial in the midst of everything that was going on in Chicago with the mafia, everything that was going on overseas, you know, Indianapolis kind of wanted to make an example. We're not going to stand for this. So the trial got all this press, and they labeled it the sensational trial of Fred S. Iozzo, and there are daily recaps in the Star and News of what happened.
I mean, this is a huge, huge story.
It was a huge story. And my family kind of did everything to separate themselves from the Italian culture during this troubling time. They even changed the name of the restaurant from Iozzo's Garden of Italy to Iozzo's Cafe later on. Because they just, you know, everybody kind of wanted to disassociate themselves with the country. And so the trial happened. My great-grandfather was eventually convicted, but convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Sentenced to prison. Didn't spend any time behind bars. Became the personal chef of the warden the day he got there.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Yes. And then was released about 18 months later. There is one of these funny side family stories is that he was denied parole his first time. And we thought maybe it was because the warden didn't want to lose his chef. So he was denied his first parole, but then released about 18 months later. And but part of the sentencing was the family was never able to get our liquor tavern license back, so they were never able to reopen the restaurant.
That was part of the punishment?
Mm-hmm. So they had lost their liquor license, and they weren't able to get it. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Now, that really is a tragic end to the story, except that the story didn't really end, right?
No,
so you come more generations down the road, and here you are. So tell me how you got back into this.
So it's a crazy thing. My my degree is not in restaurant hospitality management. It's in corporate finance. But hospitality is kind of in our blood. And we were looking at some spaces at the time to move one of our companies down to this area of Indianapolis. And we were looking at the Shimpopical building, which sits at the northern end of our block. And unfortunately, the building was too small for what we wanted to do with it. But then they were like, hey, there's a little restaurant, pizzeria set up down. Do you guys want to take a walk through? We were like, hey, okay, let's go. So we came in, and, you know, the space was good. You know, it had good bones. It had amazing brick walls and a beautiful archway. I was like, this is really nice. This could be a really cute, like, Italian panini stand. Like, you come in, you get an espresso, you stand up at the bar like you do in Italy, and you eat your lunch, and then you go back to work. And then they told me that there was a courtyard. And I was like, what? So at this point, there was a really cool 1800-style door with the two pocket windows up at top and the old brass handle. So you're trying to get this door open, right? It's creaking. It's a story, right? It's a storybook. And you just kind of open it. And then all of a sudden, there's this literally like brush at your hands where you have to push it back and then you open it. It's a secret garden style, the cobblestones, and there, at that time there was a fireplace back there, and I'm like, this is really cute. We could really make this a beautiful Italian restaurant.
Uh-oh, so it was speaking to you even then.
Like my heart started racing, and it just kind of transpired, and just then my brain started like, Katie, we could do this. This could be a really amazing space for a restaurant. We can do it. And I turned around and looked at the rest of the people, and they were like, uh-oh, she's got it in her eyes. We're opening a restaurant. So that was March 23rd. By April, I think, 7th or 8th, I was in my lawyer's office signing LLC paperwork. April 14th, we were at an auction. And by August 3rd, 2009, we were open.
Oh, my goodness. So 2009. Wow.
Yes. And I remember Mary Mills came in the very first day we opened. And she goes, what are you doing opening a restaurant in the middle of this recession? I'm like, I got lots of friends and family who love to eat spaghetti. It's like, I don't know. It's
so did it ever occur to you that it was a bad time or that it wouldn't work or any of that?
Not really. I mean, it's just one of those things that when you set your mind to something, you're going to figure out how to get it done, and we're going to make it happen. So, that was all in 2009. It was a crazy summer. We actually went to Italy. We still have family that lives there, so we went and visited them, and my mom was like, let's just make sure this pasta sauce is absolutely correct. So we went there, and of course it was. Like, the meatballs, the spaghetti, the sauce was exactly the same that we had been eating for years and years here. So that was good. And then, you know, just kind of the whole process. And my grandmother was still alive at the time. And I go, Grandma, you know, when we get into this, are you okay with me reopening Iozzo's? And she goes, well, Katie, do you have to tell the story? And I go, Grandma, if we don't, somebody else will. Right?
You have to own your story, right?
Absolutely.
This is the history.
For her, it was such a tragic event that she went through.
Yeah, she experienced that, right? She was alive during that.
She was there, saw her husband get shot, and was in the hospital with him, and you know, it's something that our family didn't talk about. It. They spoke of the fire or the troubles, but we never really knew why the restaurant had closed. And for me growing up, you know, I knew all the fun stories about the vaudeville acts coming through the restaurant and the Prohibition-style things. But we never knew why the restaurant had closed. And so for her, seeing this reopen, she was so afraid of what people would say about her and her family again. But then, you know, press started coming out, and there was this amazing article in the IBJ, and she got to be on the cover of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and she's like, they don't hate us anymore. And it was such like a really cool thing for her to see, like the reopening of the restaurant and the revitalization of our family's name and our meatballs. And so she came in and she loved it. She got standing ovation when she walked into the restaurant. It was the most beautiful thing, like such an amazing memory. And then I go, Grandma, what do you think? She goes, Katie, everything is perfect, but you make your meatballs too big. I said, Grandma. So for her wake dinner, you know, we had her, you know, when she passed away, we had everybody come to the restaurant, and we made the meatballs her size. So that was the last time we've made the small meatballs, but I thought that was so cute, Grandma.
We've been talking with Katie Harris of Iozzo's Garden of Italy in Indianapolis. We'll be right back with more from Katie on what's new with the classic Italian restaurant here on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, talking today with Katie Harris of Iozzo's Garden of Italy in downtown Indianapolis. We've been talking about her family's restaurant history, but we're also talking about the here and now, about the restaurant's location, its new signature wine created just for Iozzo's, about the upcoming Devour menu, the current dining scene, and her passion for the restaurant business. The restaurant has an incredible history.
Yeah.
You know, incredible family history.
And I feel extremely honored and privileged to be able to carry on our family's legacy. You know, I'm kind of the the face of the family right now, and I feel very blessed that I get to do that. You know, I work with some of my family members, so we've carried on the tradition of, you know, having those that are close to you work with you, and it's an amazing feeling, and I'm very honored and privileged to be able to do that. So,
but now you're carrying on the family legacy. Yeah. Obviously, you know, the restaurant is successful down here on a little piece of South Meridian Street where people probably wouldn't have expected it to be successful. So how has that been, being in this location?
I love this part of the downtown. There are, you know, still free street parking on both sides of Meridian Street. It's amazing. You know, we're not flagged for metered parking anytime soon. This neighborhood has a storied history. It's kind of one of the last untouched areas of the city, but it's so close and so accessible via the interstates, you know, right by Lucas Oil Stadium. So for the Colts games, I mean, you can't find a parking place down here. We can't find standing room in the bar during a Colts game, before a Colts game. So this area, it's great. You know, we're really close to Sacred Heart Parish, really close to Old Italian Road. You know, my family had a house where Eli Lilly corporate campus is.
Oh, that's very cool. So you really do have a connection to this area.
Yeah, and it's not the connection that drew us down here. It was the location, the location, I guess, kind of found me. But once we got into it and decided this is what we wanted to do, we thought this was a great space. You know, I'm from the south side of Indianapolis, so coming up 135, turning into Meridian Street, is something I did for 8 years of my life when I worked downtown in a high-rise. And it was just, it made sense to be on this side of town.
So do you like being in the restaurant business as someone who has a finance background? Did you take naturally to the hospitality industry?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was growing up, my mother was always the chair of committees. And so, you know, whether it was selling pizzas or hosting a canned food drive, whatever it was, those meetings were always held at our home. And my job was to greet the guests at the door, to take their jacket and ask them what they would like to drink. So being a hostess or a maitre d' or a face of your home or your family is something that I was kind of groomed to do as a child. And I think it's just in my blood. And
so neat that it's such a natural fit,
Yeah. You
know, for someone who comes from a numbers background.
Yeah, no, I'm glad that I have that aspect because I can, you know, check up the books financially at the end of the month, make sure we're not losing money, so we're good there.
And so I bet it is probably helpful to have that kind of background,
Absolutely. I know what makes sense is, you know, dollars to cents, and can, you know, finalize it all at the end of the month and make sure that our return on investments are a good thing. And hopefully this investment that I just did will plan out for us.
Well, now tell me about that. So this is a wine investment that you have going here.
So, a signature wine or a private labeled wine is something that we kind of always wanted to do. It's kind of always been something we, you know, wanted to share with our guests. Wine is such a huge portion of Italian cuisine. And last year, in May of 2016, I met Rich Hartenberger, who owns Midnight Cellars Winery in Paso Robles, California. He came in sampling me on his wines, amazing wines, and he had the Sangiovese, and I was like, well, this is delicious. I love Sangiovese. You know, it's the grape they use to make Chianti. And I was like, Rich, do you ever do private label wines? He's like, well, we've done it in the past. And I go, well, Rich, I'm your girl. I want to do this. And it's one of those things, you know, just starting the restaurant, you know, on a whim, or making a wine when I feel it, it's the right thing, I just jump on it, and I'll put everything into it. Whether it works or not, we're going to find out. But,
well, so far so good with the restaurant, right?
Yeah, so far so good. So I'm one for one there, so it's okay. So
so tell me about the wine.
So the wine, we went to California last November and helped Rich blend a wine specifically for the restaurant. So it's 95% Sangiovese grapes, all from Paso Robles, from three different vineyards. And then there's just a little bit of Merlot to kind of round out the back feel. Sangiovese can be a little flat sometimes, kind of. It's good. It has good tannins, but you just need something to kind of finish the palate. So we went out and worked with him and came up with a wine to honor 100 years of our family being in Indianapolis. So in 1916, our family arrived here. So we figured in 2016, let's go out and make a wine. So this wine is was made in 2014. Was aged in barrels for 2.5 years, and we went in with Midnight Cellars to blend it ourselves. So my family and I are very proud of what we've done, and my mom and sister wrote a really amazing little blurb about the family and the wine and why we decided to do it.
Well, what does that say? Can you read it? Read it to me?
I'd be happy to. In 1905, a 17-year-old Santoro Iozzo came to the United States to realize his American dream. By 1916, his young family had settled in Indianapolis and made it their home and livelihood. 100 years later, inspired by her great-grandfather's legacy of fine dining and entrepreneurship, Katie Harris, along with her staff, traveled to California to blend a wine to honor her family's legacy. We hope you enjoy our wine, American-grown with Italian roots, just like our family.
Oh, that's perfect.
So it's amazing, and we're so proud of what we've done. We're, you know, continuing it. Hopefully, if it... I don't want it to be a novelty, you know, something that people come in and like, oh, I heard you have a wine, let me give it a shot, and then they never order it again. It's something that I want people to really enjoy, and this wine goes amazing with our meatballs and our pork ossobuco. It just, it complements our cuisine extremely well. So in November, if we see that it's selling well, this is something that we will continue to do to kind of start a... Not a branding of the wine, because, you know, I don't know if it'll ever be sold outside of the restaurant, but we really enjoy it, and we love wine, and we love food, and it's a perfect wine for that, so.
Well, now, speaking of food, you know, this is the time of year where we talk about Devour,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you're a participant in Devour Downtown,
yes,
so tell me a little bit about that.
Sure, no, our Devour menu is pretty classic, and it's the one that we've done for 7-8 years. We decided that Devour is an amazing opportunity for diners of Indianapolis to come out, and we never wanted to change it. We always wanted it to be the 3-course, $30 menu. So at dinner time, we have amazing options. Some of our higher-end items are lobster ravioli, our filet served Iozzo style, which portobello mushrooms, red wine demi-glace, and gorgonzola crumbles on top. We do that as well as our fresh fish that we get flown in every single day, and that'll change daily. We also have a vegetarian option. We make vegetable raviolis and serve them with little fried eggplant meatballs. They're absolutely fantastic. And we're partnering with Kenwood Vineyards out of California to offer some amazing wines at $30 a bottle that would normally be $40, $50, $60 on a list. So I love Devour.
You get very excited. Now, some restaurants kind of see it as sort of a challenge or a little bit... a little bit too much trouble, so
yeah.
Clearly not.
No, here we embrace it, and we understand what it's about, and I love the Indianapolis Downtown Restaurant Association. You know, this past winter, they changed it to the entire city being on Devour, and we saw a little bit of a decline in participation, but there's just so many restaurants that people want to choose, but I'm glad that they still keep choosing Iozzo's to come to, so...
Now, what's your take on the current restaurant scene? And we've seen a lot of high-profile closures. You know, there's been talk of it being a very challenging time. How are you? What's your perspective on that?
It's one of those things that as a restaurateur, you want all the other independent restaurants to succeed. You want them to be successful because you know what hard work that you put into it when you're doing well. Imagine how much hard work and effort you're putting into it when it's not doing good. You know, you're trying to do everything to make your restaurant succeed. This is for most of us, this is our livelihood. This is how we are able to, you know, pay our mortgages. And I don't even know what to say to them. It's you know, I put every ounce of my effort into this restaurant, and I work so hard at it, and luckily we're successful here, and I want everybody to be successful. I think independent restaurants are an amazing thing, and when we opened this in 2009, there were not a ton. Iria's, Milano, you know, Amici's, there are a few other Italian restaurants that were open, and then this culture of boom, and I love it. I love that there's so many new restaurants to try here. I love that the culture has, you know, has evolved and changed, and I want them to all be successful.
Well, it is such a challenging industry.
It is.
You know, now talk a little bit about being a female owner of a restaurant, being a restaurateur in this business. Has that been, you know, harder for you? We hear a lot about you know, the challenging kitchen environment in the restaurant business.
Yeah, being a female owner is a little bit of a challenge, you know, especially when we first opened. A lot of people didn't know that a female owned this restaurant. Like, can I talk to the owner? Is he in today? And I'm like, well, he'll never be in because I own the place and he got her on the phone. What can I help you with, sort of thing? And they're like, they kind of like, what? You own this restaurant? I'm like, yes, I do. You know, there is a little bit of pushback in kitchens and, you know, people that have never worked for a woman business owner before. You know, I have a lot of passion for what I do, and I think it shows through our food, through the staff, creating that culture that we are passionate about the food, the cuisine, our family heritage. You know, it means a lot. And I think once people get into this culture, they really enjoy it. You know, I treat everybody here like a family member. You know, when you sign your name on your W-2 or W-4, you're my family. From that point on, you're an IOZO family member. And I treat everybody like family. And it might be a different approach than others have, but for here, it works.
We've been talking with Katie Harris of IOZO's Garden of Italy in Indianapolis. For more information on the restaurant, its history, and what's new, go to iozos.com. Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into the show today, and thanks also to our guests, Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird in Indianapolis, and Katie Harris of IOZO's Garden of Italy in Indianapolis as well. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, Indie.